all animals are created equal, but some animals are more equal than others. If what Napoleon suggests in George Orwell's Animal Farm is true, we wonder, which animal would you take with you when you sail off to the new world?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 684th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello, everyone.
Folks, you and I are getting ready to set sail for the new world. Each of us have been allotted one species of animal to take with us to that new world. We should, I suppose, take the animal that will best ensure our survival in the new world, but which animal would that be? As city people long since removed from the source of our food, we simply do not know, do we? Recently, the director of the local county fair told me a story that richly illustrates this point. He had contracted with a local youth authority for some youth labor to clean up the fairgrounds immediately before the grand opening of the annual fair. Midway through the day, he noticed that the youth had congregated around a 4-H barn and, fearing trouble, went to investigate. He found trouble, all right, but not the kind of trouble you would think. He found that the youth were staring in amazement at a young 4-H'er milking a cow, and realized that for perhaps the first time in their lives, these young people were learning that milk they have been drinking all their lives actually came from a cow. Now, you and I, of course, are much smarter than those inner-city youth, because we've been around the block a time or two, but do we know enough to take the right animal with us when we sail off to the new world? I think we should do a little research before we make our decision, and so today we'll talk to a fellow who's in the know, because I think he once sailed off to the new world. That would be Farmer Bruce Dunlop from Lopez Island Farm up there in the San Juan Islands of Washington State. Bruce, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello, Michael.
So you did sail off once, didn't you?
I did.
And you were, at one time in your life, you were a chemical engineer, and...
Yep.
And you decided, why did you decide to sail away from that world? Just out of curiosity.
You know, sometimes these decisions are made for us.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we make them ourselves, and some as a combination. I guess that would be my case.
And so you sailed away from the civilized world and ended up on a farm on Lopez Island. You know, for people who have not had the opportunity to visit the San Juans, it's one of the most beautiful places on Earth. How on Earth did you select Lopez Island?
Well, I was on a sailboat.
Ah.
I really did sail away.
You really did sail away. Incredible. And tell us a little bit about Lopez Island in the San Juan for people who are like listening in Florida, so that they can picture this in their mind.
It's green because we get lots of drizzle, mm-hmm. which is what it's doing right now up here.
And green means grass, of course, right?
Green means grass, except for our drought, which happens in July and August. But the rest of the year, we have sufficient moisture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a maritime climate, so that it doesn't actually ever get really hot or terrifically cold.
Right. And a beautiful island in the stream up there in Washington State, kind of right south of Canadian border, right?
Yes.
Right, good. And you became a farmer. When you were a chemical engineer, you made a transition to becoming a farmer. That must have been an interesting transition.
Well, you know, engineering is a pretty good discipline to study because it prepares you for virtually anything.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of engineering to farming, right?
There is, and there's a lot of analysis and thinking as to what, you know, what would be the best way to operate your farm, particularly the small farms that are proliferating today.
Mm-hmm.
They're diversified. they require a lot of management.
You know, Thomas Jefferson once made the remark that agriculture, farming, is a spectacle science of the first order because it requires of you a knowledge in just about everything. Would you find that to be true?
Probably. I mean, we do everything from soil science to marketing.
Mm-hmm. And there it is. So it really is a good engineering would be a good skill. So tell us a little bit about the transition. How you found your and selected your property and whatnot.
Oh, I'm probably not that different from a lot of people that land here in the islands, and they look around and as a tourist visitor, and they think it's absolutely idyllic and a wonderful place to live, and you could be a tourist all your days. And so then they buy something and fall in love with it and move up and then spend your days working.
Yeah, out of the frying pan and into the fire, right?
And the visitors come to the farm and they look around and they think, wow, how idyllic.
Uh-huh. And how beautiful and how easy and all you have to do is smile and everything happens just right for you, right?
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit about your farm.
Well, we raise sheep. And also pig.
Uh-huh, sheep and pigs.
In an integrated system. The sheep live outside on pasture all the time. And we have a climate where that can work.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sort of roll with the season.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we just finished lambing. I think spring must be the favorite time of year for me. Because that's when all the new lambs come.
Right.
And, you know, they're like little kids frolicking. Exploring their environment, and the adults kind of stand there and eat, and the little ones go flying around.
and I suppose the people that come to visit your farm during this time of year are really happy to see that too. I mean, it must be quite a spectacle for the for your guests.
The animals are a real draw. People and their children, you know, will stand there and watch the animals for
hours and
hours. They could, yes. They didn't have other things to do, but they, you know, they'll stand in the driveway and look at the little pigs running around in their field pen and, you know, digging and grunting and they're just captivated.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have been somewhat naive with respect to farm animals too when you took over this farm and you became a farmer. How did you go about learning which animal it would be best for you to raise?
Well, that's a very polite way of saying that. We knew nothing.
You knew nothing.
We knew nothing.
Well, most of us know nothing when it gets right down to it. You know, we've been removed from the source of our food for generations, and food comes wrapped in, you know, cellophane at the supermarket, and we know nothing about it. And so when you sailed away to your, you know, new world, and you landed on the shores of Lopez Island, and how did you go about learning?
Well, there are actually quite a few resources out there today, more now than there were 10 years ago when I really started this. But I had the fairly naive idea that, geez, I owned a farm. It had been a farm for a long time. I should be able to make a living farming on this piece of property. And I had no conception as to how difficult it is to make a living farming today.
Mm-hmm.
The system that we have.
Well, when you say you raise sheep and pigs, you raise grass-fed sheep and pigs, correct?
Yes, grass-fed sheep.
So there's a kind of a huge distinction there between what you're raising and what people generally buy at the store. Could you kind of describe that difference?
Well, The main difference is that the animals that we have don't eat any grain.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pretty good body of evidence out there now that consuming the meat from ruminant animals that live solely on grass and brush and forage, their sort of natural diet, that meat is better for us. From a health standpoint, than animals that are put in feedlots and fed grain, which is really an unnatural diet for an animal.
So you're trying to tell us that when animals eat what they're naturally eat, that they're better food for us than if we feed them something that is unnatural for them to eat, right?
Right. And it's better for them, too.
It's better for them, yeah. And, well, I think, you know, a lot of research has been done with respect to long-chain omega-3 fatty acids and the relationship of the essential fatty acids in animals that have been grain-fed versus grass-fed, because the long-chain omega-3s come from green, and the sixes come from the grains. So we have this tremendous imbalance now in our diets in the essential fatty acids. And so you have a little niche or a way of competing with the industrial animal producers out there that have large acreages of feedlots, and right, you're actually growing a different kind of product.
You're right. It's a different product, and it's one that at least a segment of the consumer, you know, consuming public today values and will pay a premium for. And more than that, they'll go out of their way to obtain it.
And when it comes to going out of your way, Lopez Island is really out of the way of a lot of people, right?
Well, it's that, and it's also, you know, in the way that they purchase. When you're going through your grocery store shopping, you can't just pick it up because it's not there.
Right.
In most locations. You have to go to farmers markets, or you have to find the farmers. You have to do a little work.
You have to work for your food. Folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're having a little bit of fun talking about which animal you would take when you sail away to the New World. Bruce Dunlop sailed away from the New World. He was a chemical engineer, and he got on a boat and sailed away and ended up in Lopez Island, Washington, and which animals did he take? We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, hello, we're back, and you and I are off to the New World in our sailboat, and the question is, what kind of animal are we going to bring along? We each allotted one. Which will yours be? Will it be I don't know. We're going to find out what Bruce Dunlop did when he sailed away to the New World from his position as a chemical engineer. He got on a sailboat and took off, landed up there in Lopez Island, Washington, which is a stunningly beautiful place. One of the attributes of that neck of the woods is that it rains a lot, which means the grass grows a lot, which means that animals can eat grass almost all year long. A hugely significant thing, because a lot of our farms are based on grass. And then in what industrial agriculture did was they made the transition from feeding animals grass to feeding them grain. And that made a huge difference in the availability of food and the quality of that food and the nutrients that are in that food. Changed our world. And some people are going back to those grass-fed animals in the search for nutrition. And that's the market which Bruce Dunlop is catering to up there in Lopez Island, Washington. Who is your market? Where are your customers, Bruce? Are your customers on the island, or do they come to the island?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
I have customers that, you know, live here, and also visitors to the island. But we also have a group of customers in the greater Seattle area,
mm-hmm,
that we deliver to.
Oh, you do? Okay.
And this is where the internet has
changed the world.
It is the great equalizer.
Yep, it sure is. It sure levels the playing field for everybody, doesn't it?
Because now we can send out a notice that we're going to be delivering to 80 people, 100 people, 200 people. It doesn't matter. It doesn't take any longer. If they're on our list, they get the notice.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do all of our correspondence by email.
Right.
And through the web page, which eliminates all that time you would spend on the telephone trying to contact people and leave messages back and forth. And,
right.
So that's really helped. So we have a group of really dedicated customers who, you know, put in their orders every month.
Do your customers feel like they own you?
I'm their farmer.
Yeah. And what you when I talked with you on the phone earlier, you talked about what happens when they pull in your driveway and they just sit there and watch the animals.
Right.
Is that for the kids?
Adults
do it as well.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very open farm.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasant place to be.
So it's totally unlike the cattle feedlots, right?
I can't imagine wanting to wander around in a cattle feedlot right now.
No, hard to imagine that one. Let's talk about your animals, Bruce. And you pulled into port there in Lopez Island, Washington, and being a chemical engineer, you sat down and figured out, well, I'm going to raise some animals, and which animals am I going to raise? How did you go about figuring that out?
Well, you know, mostly I looked at the fields and realized that I needed to do something with them and looked around at what other people were doing. And there's a community here of small farmers,
mm-hmm.
and there are a lot of sheep raised on, you know, in the islands for
right.
a number of reasons. But because of that, there was help. You know, there were people who would sell you some sheep to get started, and then they'd
uh-huh.
hold your hand and teach you a few things while you learned. And I started with 5 practice sheep.
So you started with sheep?
I started with sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And then we gradually added a few pigs each year, and then a few more, and then a few more. And we've kind of stabilized. Right now, I think there's 100 and something sheep on the property, 25 pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the numbers, you can't live on that.
You can't
live on those few animals. But they do provide a significant portion, you know, of
mm-hmm.
of our income.
Okay, well, and in truth be known, I suspect many small farmers have many different sources of income, too. I guess that's one of the survival mechanisms of the world. You know, you can't really rely on one thing, and many small farmers have other things going as well, so that would make some sense. Tell us a little bit about the difference between these two animals, and why didn't you select other animals? For example, why didn't you go with cattle? Or cows?
Well, we had a couple one year.
Uh-huh. What happened?
Well, they're big.
They're big. Good thing you didn't have buffalo, huh?
And when they got out and visited the neighbors, you know, the neighbors were terrified of them.
Because they're so big, yeah.
And they're standing in their garden.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it wasn't... cows require another level of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And skill. And
like big fences?
Like bigger fences.
Uh-huh.
And, sheep turned out to be what I would consider for us a manageable size.
When you say animal. Manageable, are they manageable in just in the respect that they're easy to manage themselves, or that the infrastructure is easy to build?
Well, you know, they don't outweigh me 10 to 1.
Right.
The infrastructure is a bit lighter, and lamb's a premium product. You know,
okay,
so then
we're talking about land. The amount of land you need for cattle is probably much greater than the amount of land you need for sheep and pigs, right?
On an individual basis, yes.
Okay, good. So that's a significant consideration then, the amount of land you have and the characteristics of that land.
Right.
Okay. The difference between lamb and sheep, or sheep and pigs.
And pigs.
Yeah.
Well, in my pig operation, I purchase baby pigs from a couple of people who raise them.
Okay. What are they called?
Wiener pigs.
Okay.
And they're about 30 pounds when they're 7 or 8 weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
and they're wiener pigs because they've just been weaned from their mother.
Right.
So I'm not breeding them. So I'm bring in a litter of small pigs, and then I feed them for about 6 months.
Okay.
And at which point, they're no longer 30 pounds, they're 300 pounds.
Woo! And now, that how long does that take?
That takes 6 months.
6 months from 30 pounds to 300 pounds?
Yeah, and about 800 or 900 pounds of grain.
So
they live outside on the pasture. They eat everything they can find, but mostly they eat grain.
Okay. And pigs are, of course, omnivores, right?
Right.
And does that mean you allow them to run around and eat what they want, what they can find?
They eat what they want and find. Mm-hmm. You know, but remember, they're in a pasture.
Right.
And they eat grass. And if you could imagine trying to gain that much weight eating lettuce.
Yeah, right.
you know, you have to eat spaghetti if you want to gain that much weight.
Mm-hmm.
So
you find grain for them. Grain for them?
So we buy grain for them. And by the time they're done with the patch of ground they're on, they've pretty much rototilled it.
Right.
And fertilized it.
Mm-hmm. Joel Salatin calls them pig-a-raters.
That's right. And they're very good at that. They like that job.
Mm-hmm.
And we go in, and they don't leave it very smooth, though.
Right. So you kind of have to run a cultivator across it.
Right.
Once in a while.
We go in and till it and reseed it. And then we find that particular patch of ground has the best grass growth for the sheep of any place on the farm.
Oh, good. We're going to pick that up when we come back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about which animal you would take with you when you sail away to the new world. Paul or Bruce took sheep and pigs. What would you take? Right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about farm animals and which animal you would take with you when you sail off to the new world. Which would it be? You have one to take. You have so many to from which to select. So which would it be? I originally hoped to have a farmer from Michigan, Paul Kaiser, with us today, but he was unable to join us. I picked up a piece that he wrote in Acres USA, and this is how he describes the wondrous pig, the cleanest, most exuberant farm animal. Pigs are the most intelligent farm animal. Being omnivores, they also are capable of eating the widest assortment of farm byproducts. Pigs make the fastest gains in growth, body size, and reproductive capacity. Pigs are the cleanest animal on the farm if given good bedding, and they deposit their droppings in the corner of a pen or a yard. Bruce, this sounds just about the opposite of what we expect from the pig. You know, we always think of them as being the dirtiest, filthiest farm animals. What is the truth in that?
It's mixed.
Mixed. Figured that.
You know, the little white pigs pretty much always have dirty noses because they spend most of their time sleeping, eating, or with their nose underground.
And they're rooters, aren't they?
They are. They graze about 3 inches below ground.
And they pile up the ground for you, and you have to go in and fix that ground, but it makes it incredibly fertile. How does that work?
Well, the biggest part of that is you're feeding them, and the food becomes fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So you're adding nutrients.
So then really nothing goes to waste.
No. And then it recycles back into the sheep. A little bit leaves the farm in the form of meat. That's where the yield is.
Sure, that's where you make your profit then. That's where the money's at.
But you ship less nutrients off the farm as meat than you do if you're shipping something like a grain product.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it sounds so different than the industrial model where you have all of these tens of thousands of pigs in one, you know, little location, and, you know, you put all the grain into them and then you throw away all the good stuff, I guess.
Well, you're taking what we use as a fertilizer in limited amounts, which is very beneficial, and you end up with lagoons of it, and then it becomes a hazardous waste.
Yeah. So what to you is a valuable resource, to them then becomes a hazardous waste. Let's go to Marshall. Marshall, are you there?
Yeah.
Turn your radio off.
I got it off.
Okay.
instantly when he asked the question, I thought dog. And then you brought up cows. So I have a funny story that my dad had a 100-acre ranch in, just north of Santa Barbara, the Hollister Ranch. It was private property. And we had pigs, cows, and avocado trees. And once I was walking back from surfing, you could walk a mile to go surfing at the best waves in California by yourself. And I had my surfboard, and there was a mom cow with a calf. And I'm walking with my surfboard, and she charged me and ran me into one of my dad's ponds.
Well, at least you had a surfboard, right?
I had a surfboard, but I jumped off about an 8-foot cliff because this cow, there was no way to scare it off. She had her calf, and I had my surfboard, and she didn't like that at all.
She was kind of protecting her calf. Well, let me ask you, Marshall. You brought up the notion of your first thought would be your first animal you would take with you would be a dog. How would a dog help you survive in the new world?
Because it'll protect you, and that's my point. I got ran off the cliff, and for some reason I didn't take my dog down surfing that day. So after I was down in the pond in a cliff on one side and Thule's on the other, I had no way out, so I was calling my dog.
There you go.
And I was trapped in this thing for like 45 minutes with this big cow looking down on me with her big eyes saying, "You ain't getting out of there, you ain't coming near my calf."
Well, that's a pretty good story. And I guess that's one of the things that Bruce was talking about. The cows are pretty big, and I guess that's why. Thanks for the call, Marshall. Appreciate it. And I guess that's why your neighbors would be frightened of the cows, right, Bruce?
Yes, they're big.
They're big, and they're protective, just like all other animals. So if you're threatening them, you're going to be in trouble. So the difference in pigs and sheep. Sheep, you know, we hear about as being very docile, okay? I guess they are the epitome of being docile, but not pigs, right?
Well, you know, I realize the basic difference between them is that sheep are prey, and they act like prey, mm-hmm. because pretty much everything likes to eat them. And so they respond, you know, flocking together and being skittish. And pigs are not prey.
They're actually predators, aren't they?
Yeah, to a point.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly they just kind of go wherever they want and nothing bothers them. And they're, you know, they're sort of big enough and tough enough that, you know, if they want to go there, they go there. If there's a fence in the way, they go through it or under it.
Yeah. What makes them so suitable for going feral? For going, you know, for reverting back to the wild. And it seems to be throughout the United States, we have a lot of that wildness running around.
It's a big issue in places, particularly where there are forests of nut trees.
Uh-huh.
Because they can survive on nuts. And I know California has a great problem with feral, mm-hmm. feral pigs. They also like grubs and earthworms, which is why they dig up your yards.
So they eat just about. Well, that's really what, you know, gives them the ability to survive so readily is that they can survive on just about anything that's food.
That's right.
And thus that probably is a huge difference. Now, the relationship between pigs and sheep. Now, also when we were talking, you talked about goats, and engineer Nikki James. When I asked her what kind of animal she would take. She immediately mentioned goats. What about that?
Well, I think goats would be a good choice. They're relatively small. They're manageable. They're companionable. They provide milk
and cheese,
which is one of our favorite foods.
Mm-hmm.
And they reproduce fairly reliably. And you can eat them.
And you can eat them. So they're a very valuable animal in that respect. You can get a lot out of them. And they eat everything, too, don't they? I mean, they're totally voracious when it comes to voracious herbivores.
They are.
I know, because I took one home once, and it ate all my mother's roses. in about a minute, you know. So
right.
They're terribly voracious when it comes to eating. Are they docile?
Yeah, they can be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have several goats here, mainly to eat brush,
mm-hmm.
and they follow you around like dogs.
Yeah. They're kind of like pets, aren't they?
They are. They are pets.
Are they protective in the sense that they watch over you too?
Not particularly.
Not particularly? Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking about farm animals with farmer Bruce Dunlop. Bruce was a chemical engineer that sailed away to the New World, and his New World was the Lopez Island up in the San Juan Islands of Washington State. Truly a paradise if you've ever seen it. A beautiful, beautiful green world of rainfall and grass. And so what do you do when you have rainfall and grass? Well, you can raise some animals the way that nature intended them to be raised, which was eating the green of grass rather than the brown of grains, and thus producing animals rich in long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, which are brain food, the things that we need to be smart. And when we eat too much of the omega-6s, which is what we get when we eat too much industrial meats, we lose that intelligence, or so some would say. What do you say? What animal would you take with you when you sail away to the New World? Right back. Well, they say, or Napoleon the Pig once said, that all animals are created equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Which animal would be more equal if for you to take with you as you sail across the seas to the New World? That's a question that it's interesting to note that if you follow the path of the Polynesians or the Polynesian people as they migrated out of New Zealand up toward Hawaii, you can follow their path across the islands of the Pacific, and what you find they left behind were pigs. So pigs must have been very valuable to them. Would that make sense to you, Bruce?
Well, you know, the Spanish explorers that came to the New World mm-hmm. in 1500 arrived in, you know, off the Caribbean islands and came up through Florida. They brought pigs with them,
right?
As well as horses and other animals. And you have to realize that this group of explorers didn't travel very fast. They herded the pigs along with them. The pigs sort of foraged their way through the forest. They didn't feed them. And a couple of years later, after they'd been exploring and heading back, they had more pigs than they started with, and they'd been eating pork pretty regularly.
So that they really were a way for the explorers to feed themselves without really growing.
That's right.
Any crops. I mean, the pigs just took care of them in that respect.
Right, and that legacy are the feral pigs that are mm-hmm. throughout the East and on some of the offshore islands in the Carolinas. There was a group that ended up living there, pretty isolated for several hundred years.
Right.
And they trace their origin back to the pigs that the Spanish brought with them. So,
so essentially, a domesticated animal, it still has the smarts to survive on its own.
Right.
Okay. Well, Bruce, you market to a population of city people. How do you market your products to those city people? Because they must have to pay more for your products than they do from, you know, that they can get from the industrial food chain. How do you do that?
They do pay some more, not like double or triple, but there's a premium there.
Mm-hmm.
Marketing actually, in some ways, is fairly easy right now, in that there's not that many of us producing this product, and there's a huge population of people
that want it,
that are interested in it, and you know, there's a small set that really want it, and that's as many as we need for customers. And every time some article comes out in the press about a food scare or a safety issue, we get more calls.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the new food rules that the federal government is cooking up, and how they are going to impact you and people like you?
You know, some, and unfortunately those regulations are really geared toward mm-hmm. fixing problems after they happen on big farms.
Sure, they're designed to protect us from things that go wrong in the industrial food chain.
Yep.
And of course, none of them really apply to you, but the rules will apply to you. And
they do. And we live with them because mm-hmm. we operate meat processing facilities.
Now, That's a really interesting one. How do you go about having the ability to process your animals? Because that must be, you know, one of the most strictest and most problematic obstacles to overcome. How do you do that?
Well, as a group of farmers here in the islands and now sort of this little corner of Washington, we are part of a co-op that owns and operates our own processing facility.
Oh, okay.
And that we were the first mobile facility in the country to do on-farm and USDA-inspected processing.
And you actually pulled that off. They've been trying to work that here in California, and it's just been getting to the point where they're able to do that, but it's been a monumental struggle. Now, why is it a monumental struggle?
Because it's new and different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, we've been doing it now for 10 years, and there's a handful of others around the country that have, you know, modeled something after what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulatory agency, at least the USDA, is now, I would say comfortable with it. It's been working well long enough.
Mm-hmm.
That they are, not only are they comfortable with it, but they are actually issuing guidelines and assistance documents for people that want to do it, helping educate people.
So it looks like this is starting to work on a very small scale right now, but it could be a very large scale. Do you think that this is a threat to, you know, the other model, the other way of doing things, the industrial model?
It's, you know, it's not a threat in terms that we're going to take over their market because we're going to get so big. But I think it's a perception threat.
That
people look at what they're producing and they look at what we're producing and they make a decision as to which they would prefer to feed their children.
Don't you think that's a real threat?
I think it's a danger for a highly industrial food mm-hmm. system.
And thus a threat.
You know, the fact that the European Union won't allow beef that's been given growth hormones
there it
sold
is.
In the EU, right?
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you, Bruce Dunlop, which animal you would take with you if you could take one with you and why. And when we come back, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Bruce Dunlop, farmer, Lopez Island Farms, way up there in the beautiful state of Washington. Right back. Well, folks, which animal would you take with you if you could take one animal with you to across the seas to the New World? Bruce Dunlop sailed across the seas to the New World, quite literally. Chemical engineer down here in California, got in a sailboat and sailed away and ended up on a Lopez Island up in the San Juan Islands of Washington State. Well, so Bruce, I have to ask you, which one animal would you take with you?
Well, you know, right now I'm leaning toward goats.
Uh-huh. Agree with Nikki James here.
Yes.
Why is that?
Just the multitude of
of things that you could do.
And their heart and their general hardiness.
Mm-hmm. Why not a pig?
You know, it's hard to give up bacon, but it would be harder to give up cheese.
Okay, fair enough.
I can't imagine milking a pig.
It would be an interesting experiment. Why not chickens?
You know, I've just never developed a fondness for chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, on the table.
Right. Okay, but because they kind of have the ability to get by, too.
They do.
So that would be one.
You know, I'd really have to be like Noah and take, you know...
Well, of course, we'd all want to take a bunch of animals, and you know, the kind of farm I was raised on had a bunch of animals, the whole spectrum were there, everything, I think, and they all seemed to find a way of getting along, and yet, like Napoleon said in Animal Farm, so some were appeared to be more equal than others, and
right.
The pigs were certainly of that ilk. They thought very well of themselves. But when it comes to getting along, they're, you know, getting by in the world and the food that they can provide us, I guess what we really look for are those animals that can produce the most from the least on their own, right?
Yeah.
And to your estimation, that would be the goat.
I think so.
And for us city people looking at food and the animal foods, Paul, what should we be looking for so that we can get the most from the least when it comes to buying the meats for our table? I mean, we've pretty much lost track of those things. We don't really know. We're in many respects, we're like those young people that the fair manager spoke about, and we gaze upon the 4-H'er milking the cow and realize that, wow, milk comes from a cow. We all think we're much smarter than that, but we really, you know, we're really babes in the woods anymore because we're so far removed from our food.
Right.
What can we do?
You know, I mean, I'm biased, of course, right? I have a small farm,
sure.
And I would like customers to purchase products from small farms near them and support that. The whole system we have of agriculture in this country, in North America, is not a sustainable one because it's built on low-cost energy. And if you remember when gas hit $4 a gallon a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of hand-wringing about that.
And the cost of chemical nitrogen went...
Cost of fertilizer.
Yeah.
And the cost of transport. And at the same time, the price of grain went through the roof for a combination of factors that all sort of happened at the same time,
mm-hmm.
worldwide. And all of a sudden, the feedlot model was a big money loser for those companies. And they just rode it out and lost money for a year. You know, and the price of corn is back down again, and the government is subsidizing it. I mean, that the taxpayers are subsidizing it. So the model is, is restored.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had sustained periods of high oil prices and consequently higher grain prices, you'd find that the grass-fed
is the way to go.
Is all of a sudden less expensive.
We're out of time. Paul, or Bruce, thank you so much for joining us. Bruce Dunlop, Lopez Island Farm, Washington State, with Real Food. Thank you so much, Bruce.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.